Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We want to welcome today two high schools. One, Valley Christian High School. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Platteville High School. Would they stand? It's good seeing you too. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. This program, called Court with Class, invites students from around the state to come and join the court for an oral argument. And if the students accept this invitation, they are sent copies of the briefs in the case we are about to hear, and they may engage in other activities relating to this case. The other part of this program is that the students may meet with a justice of this court right after this second oral argument. And the discussion will be on the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case that we are about to hear. Everyone in the courtroom is invited to attend the session with the justice. It will be a surprise justice today because this justice is not sitting on this case. Ordinarily, it's Justice Wilcox sits to my immediate right, but you will recognize him because he'll wear a black robe. So let me introduce the other members of the court. My now next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks. On my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Does anyone in the courtroom need a summary or want a summary of the case they're about to hear? It's easier to listen to oral arguments if you have a familiarity with the facts and the legal issues. If you would like a summary of the case, just raise your hand, please. All right. We shall proceed with the second case, which is Bruce City Redevelopment Group, LLC, versus Furchill Group, 04AP3238. Arguing on behalf of the Furchill Group is Matthew W. O'Neill. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning. May it please the Court. This case presents an issue that has been recurring in Wisconsin for a long time. And that is, when can a party alleging a breach of contract also seek to recover punitive damages? Long ago, this court held that punitive damages are not available in recovery for a breach of contract, no matter how willful the breach, and also that there is no such thing as a claim for a tortious breach of contract. Recent jurisprudence in the context of commercial claims seeking to recover only economic damages has held that tort claims are barred, generally, except in very rare circumstances, most recently as set forth in Kaladi. The plaintiff here has demonstrated admirable creativity in fashioning six separate tort claims out of the non-performance of a commercial real estate contract. The central themes of the plaintiff's efforts in fashioning these tort claims were two. The first was to allege malice, generally, with respect to the non-performance of the contract. And the second was to disaggregate the various actors who acted on behalf of an LLC and to allege individual claims against them for interference with the contract and for conspiracy. Two things are particularly notable about the plaintiff's purported tort claims. The first is that each relies on the same allegations that make up the breach of contract claim. The second is that each seeks damages by referring back specifically to paragraph 90 of the complaint, which sets forth the alleged damages for the breach of contract. The only additional damages sought, based upon the tort claims, are punitive damages. And this Court should reject these efforts at artful pleading and ensure that this commercial real estate dispute goes back down to the lower court to be litigated as a commercial contract dispute without any issues of punitive damages or potential personal liability of the individual corporate actors. Out of the six alleged torts in the complaint, Brew City's sole remaining tort claim is a common law civil conspiracy tort claim that is based upon the criminal statute of section 134.01.
Counsel, I just want some clarification. The allegation in the ninth claim, or rather than say the allegation, the ninth cause of action was dismissed. That's not a subject of our review, is it?
Well, the ninth claim, as stated, is stated as a separate claim for punitive damages. Judge Sankovitz at the trial court level dismissed all of the tort claims, and he said since there are no remaining tort claims, there can be no claim for punitive damages, and so that is also considered dismissed. The Court of Appeals reinstated, it reversed Judge Sankovitz with respect to the civil conspiracy claim under 134.01, which in turn brings the punitive damages back into the case. It's not necessarily stated as a separate claim. It's really an item of damages that has to be pinned to tortious conduct.
As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, and it went through step by step the different causes of action, and it was causes of action 3, 6, and 7, which were the subject of this review, and not 9, punitive. So, but it's your position, as you interpret the plaintiff, that the ninth cause of action remains in this case for our review. Is that your position?
That's correct, Your Honor, with one caveat, and that is, from defendant's perspective, the ninth claim is not viewed particularly as a claim in and of itself. It is a request for punitive damages, which would be available upon proof of a tort and then proof of the elements for punitive damages. So, yes,
it's really a claim for relief. You don't view it as a cause of action.
Correct.
That's why you're not fussing with it. If
that's
the
right.
Tort claims go out, the claim for relief goes out. If the tort claim, if this court would say that the tort claims are okay, as the Court of Appeals did, then paragraphs 124 and 125, which are punitive damages, are in the case.
Yes.
Okay.
The tort claim that remains, the civil conspiracy claim under section 134.01, is subject to dismissal on two separate legal grounds. The first, as the Court is aware, is the economic loss doctrine. The second is the intra-corporate conspiracy doctrine. And I would like to begin by discussing the intra-corporate conspiracy doctrine, which, unlike the economic loss doctrine, has never been addressed by this Court previously. A common law conspiracy under section 134.01, like any other common law conspiracy, requires that two or more persons combine to take an act. What the intra-corporate conspiracy doctrine recognizes is that corporate entities and their agents and their officers and their employees and their subsidiaries cannot conspire with one another because their coordinated activity is viewed as part of a single enterprise. This rule was set forth by the United States Supreme Court in Copperweld in the context of a Sherman Act claim and has been applied in Wisconsin, at least at the Court of Appeals level, to a conspiracy claim under section 134.01. The public policy behind the rule...
Wausau Medical?
Wausau Medical also did not talk of the doctrine in terms of the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine, but it applied the same principle, which is in that case that a doctor and his own LLC could not conspire with one another to take an action because it was really a single entity acting. And so what the legal theory is that where you have combined action by various employees and agents and subsidiaries of a single economic enterprise. They are not separate interests that are combining to cause harm, but they are a single actor. And in this case, the court can look at pages 3 or page 31 of our brief, which is the red brief. And that sets forth a chart that outlines, I think, in more comprehensive form, the relationship between the various defendants.
Do the parties agree with that? Does the plaintiff agree? I mean, I didn't think that they agreed with your chart. Now, you may be able to prove your chart, but we're not at that stage yet.
Oh, we're at the stage where the motion to dismiss stage, their pleading is all we have.
Mm-hmm.
It is taken as true.
Mm-hmm.
And what the chart in our brief does is tracks precisely the language set forth in the paragraphs of the complaint that describes the relationship between these parties and how all of them relate to Juneau Avenue Partners. Mr. Cannon obviously can address if he believes there's any errors in the chart, but we certainly believe it accurately tracks the complaint.
My review of the Copperweld case, where you have the parent company and the subsidiary, is that there was a unity of interests and that the subsidiary acted for the benefit of the parent. Can you say that same thing about this LLC? Can this LLC control its members the same way that a parent controls its subsidiary? Is there necessarily the same unitary interest?
There is the same unitary interest, Your Honor, and that comes from reviewing the complaint. What the complaint sets forth in relatively great detail compared to some pleadings I've seen is an assignment agreement between Bruce City and Wispark that itself contemplates the creation of a new entity that is going to purchase the PAPS property, develop the property, and provide Bruce City with the consideration required under the contract. The complaint alleges Juneau Avenue Partners was created, that it acquired the property, and that the two parties thereafter negotiated with each other about the items that Bruce City felt it was entitled to under the contract and the manner in which it felt it was entitled to receive them. All of the allegations of the complaint support only one inference, and that is that all the acts on the side of the table of Juneau Avenue Partners were pursued precisely for Juneau Avenue Partners' interests. Most particularly, if you look at the paragraph 99, which is the operative paragraph of the tortious interference claim, what you see is an allegation that Mr. Franke, Mr. Virgil, and JTMK in that claim acted together for the purpose of furthering Juneau Avenue Partners' interests. And all of the remaining allegations, I think, support the same conclusion, which is there was a unitary interest on the side of the transaction of the defendants, which was to further Juneau Avenue Partners. This case does fall directly under the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine and directly under the reasoning of Copperweld, which didn't so much look at it as a question of control, but whether the various entities were related and united in interest and acting as a single economic enterprise, which is precisely what we have here. In fact, if you look at it from the opposite angle, if the intracorporate conspiracy does not apply, you would have a situation where this entity, Juneau Avenue Partners, is created. It's a single-purpose entity for the purpose of developing the PAPS properties. It's done so with the acquiescence and agreement of Bruce City. And if it is not considered a single entity, then any alleged tort or other conduct of Juneau that was taken by its various agents, if somebody has to act on its behalf, would become a conspiracy. And that not only would violate the intracorporate conspiracy doctrine, but it could also do serious damage to our concept in Wisconsin that LLCs are to be the sole entity reliable for an LLC's own liabilities.
There are exceptions to the LLC immunity from liability.
Yes, there are exceptions to, in fact, those exceptions track throughout all of the legal arguments involved in this appeal. And that is, a member or manager can be liable if they act other than as a member or manager. The intracorporate conspiracy doctrine, there are also exceptions where alleged members of the conspiracy are not acting to further the interests of the economic enterprise, but are furthering their own interests.
Well, you half won at the Court of Appeals because they said, we're going to dismiss without prejudice and allow repleting. So what's the matter with allowing them to replead?
Your Honor, what's the matter with it is that the Court of Appeals said more than that, and what they said was error. What the Court of Appeals said, and it's not said directly, but this is a reasonable reading of the Court of Appeals opinion, is that if Bruce City goes back and alleges that Mr. Frankie and Furchill acted with malice and that in doing so they caused a breach of the contract, that that would be sufficient to support a tortious interference claim. The law in Wisconsin, at least as set forth in Sprecher and in Lorenz and in Mendelson, says that in order for a corporate agent to incur personal liability as having interfered with the corporation's contract, that person has to have acted with an improper motive. And the facts in those cases suggest an improper motive only exists where there is a personal motive that is inconsistent with the interests of the company at issue. Therefore, while the leave to replead in and of itself is an issue under Section 802.09 for the trial court's discretion, this court should, in its policymaking function, correct the error of the Court of Appeals in the manner in which that court suggested a repleading could be accomplished that would state an actionable claim.
Counselor, I want to look a little bit at the Section 134 claim. That's a claim that used to be casually referred to as the business slander claim. It doesn't really, in my view, have anything to do with whether or not there is a contract between two people, but involves conduct that is sanctioned by an act of the legislature. Would you agree with me that far?
I would agree that the statute itself creates a misdemeanor and declares what is punishable conduct that is absolutely unrelated to whether there's a contract.
That's right. Okay. So if it's unrelated to the contract, and that's what they're alleging, and I'm not saying they are, I'm just saying we're going to assume that for the purposes of my question. If it's unrelated to the contract, and they're alleging a claim under Section 134, what do we even need to look at this malicious interference or whatever the court, malevolent action exception that the Court of Appeals spoke of? Why do we even need to talk about that?
Well, if the question addresses the application of the economic loss doctrine to the civil conspiracy claim,
right.
I would agree that the Court of Appeals malevolent action exception is not the appropriate inquiry. And as we've set forth in our briefs under the economic loss jurisprudence, the appropriate inquiry where there is a contractual relationship between the parties and the party attempts to allege a tort, because while the tort...
Fine, I understand where you are. Go ahead. What's the appropriate... I mean, and just looking at 134 now, I don't want you to tell me about everything else. What's the appropriate inquiry in regard to 134 when the parties may have a contract and there's a 134 claim?
The appropriate inquiry is first whether there are economic damages that are sought that arise out of a contractual relationship. And if so...
You're mixing me up because I thought we agreed that 134 has nothing to do with whether there's a contract or not.
Your Honor, 134.01, you were asking about the statute. The statute is a criminal statute.
Right.
What we have here is a civil claim that relies for some of its elements, but not all, on the statute. And the one element that the statute does not address is damages. And this Court's jurisprudence going back to 1901...
No, I disagree with you, Counselor. I think the statute talks about slander to one's business reputation. Now, I'm not saying the complaint is sufficient for that. That's not what I'm talking about. But just assume that it were. Slandering someone's business reputation has nothing to do with whether the people involved have a contract with one another, correct? I mean, you could slander my business reputation and we don't have a contract, right?
Yeah, yes.
That statute doesn't speak to anything to do with a contract. It's extra contractual. It doesn't need a contract. right?
Correct. You can violate that statute.
So with that in mind, since we do have a contract here, okay, how does that, in your mind, change what the statute regulates? Or maybe it doesn't change what the statute regulates.
I don't think the fact of the contractual relationship changes one bit what the statute regulates.
Good. I agree with you.
But what we have here is a civil conspiracy claim that refers back to the criminal statute and says where that conduct causes damages, that the damages are the gist of the claim. That's the language going back to 1901. For the criminal prosecution, the conspiracy is the gist of the action. For the civil claim, the damages are the gist.
Right, but the damages may not be the same as breach of contract damages. If you're slandering someone's business reputation, don't they have to show a damage to their business reputation and what that amounts to in dollar amounts?
They may. As alleged here, the damages are the same as the breach of contract.
Right, but isn't this one of the claims they're going to replead or they have an opportunity to replead?
Under 80209, a party can always attempt to replead.
Yeah.
But the civil conspiracy tort claim in their complaint was not one of the ones subject to repleading. It was one that was the Court of Appeals reversed and said that claim was appropriate under the malevolent action exception.
Okay. And I that's where I kind of started out with, you know, if in fact this is a claim that is extra contractual, and I thought we agreed that it was, you don't need a contract to bring this claim, then I was not understanding of the Court of Appeals decision and why they even need to talk about this malevolent action theory. And that's what I was trying to get a dialogue, and I'm not doing it very artfully. I don't see the connection, to be quite frank, between malevolent action exception and the statute, because the statute doesn't require a contract. So I don't really understand the Court of Appeals' opinion, and maybe you can help me with
that. Well, if I could just clarify one thing, and that is, while I agree with you that the statute in and of itself, the criminal statute, exists regardless of whether there's a contract.
Right.
The civil conspiracy claim that's based on the statute, that in fact is a tort, it is not a statutory claim, does require an element of damages. And in this case, the only damages alleged are those that arise from the contract.
See,
so we have the relationship here.
To me, there are two things that I thought were pleaded. And, I mean, I read the pleadings, and I agree with you. The complaint is quite detailed. One part of the civil conspiracy was to interfere with the contract between Brew City and Wiss Park, which essentially got shuttled down to Juneau. Okay, that was one part of the conspiracy. The other claim that was tortious under 134 was damage to business reputation. Not that you didn't perform the contract, but that what you said or did or whatever, because the pleadings are woefully short in regard to alleging a business slander cause of action, was that you injured that person's reputation. Not that you just didn't perform the contract, but that you injured the reputation. Am I wrong in that?
No, you're absolutely correct. But Your Honor could also take note that in paragraph 115, which is the third paragraph of the Section 134 civil conspiracy claim, they talk about the damages. They say as a result of the malicious and intentional injury, they've sustained financial other injuries, and they refer back to paragraph 90. And this is important. Paragraph 90 sets forth
the breach of contract. I agree with you.
And that includes alleged damages for damage to Brew City's business and reputation.
But,
so in this pleading.
Yeah. It's all mushed together.
Well, where we see the economic loss doctrine being applicable in the first instance is we know it's applicable to commercial real estate contracts under Van Laer. We know it applies generally unless there's an exception. And this is how the Court of Appeals got to its malevolent action exception. It was looking for an exception, and it read that into Collati. As we've said in our brief, Collati absolutely doesn't support it. What it does support is an analysis that says in some circumstances where the alleged tortious conduct is extraneous to the contractual relationship, and in that case where it's fraudulent inducement preceding the contract, that in those circumstances you can have a claim. What we learned from DigiCorp and from other cases is that where there is alleged non-performance of a contract, that can never be held to be extraneous to the contract.
Right, but I guess I'm still, and maybe it's just me, I don't seem to be able to. Is there, in your opinion, is there any conduct alleged at all in the complaint that is extra contractual?
No.
So that's your complaint about it. So then they couldn't maintain this claim because you don't think there are, even read most broadly, this pleading can go forward.
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint read fairly and with all reasonable inferences does not allege any conduct by any of the defendants that is in any way extraneous to the issue of the contract, which was the development of the PAPS properties.
Okay. Thank you. That's probably where I should have asked you with my first question.
Go ahead.
The Court of Appeals speaks of harm for harm's sake is extra to any contract. Can you respond to that? I mean, that's not part of a contract that someone, you can't expect that they would be intentionally trying to cause harm for harm's sake. That's not within the anticipation of a contract.
Well, the anticipation of the contract is two parties that get together and say, we're going to do X together. In this case, it's an assignment and it's going to be the development of this PAPS property. In commercial contracts, it is common that is not, and this shines forth from some of the amicus briefs from the folks that actually engage in this on a daily basis, that there are hard feelings, that there are conversations that are not pleasant, that there are expletives used. And what Judge Sankovitz held and what the defendants believe is that the mere inclusion of an alleged curse word and the invocation of the term malice is not sufficient to support the allegation that there is seven different parties combining to cause harm for harm's sake. And what the plaintiffs have done in putting together a very full set of pleadings is actually demonstrated that the purposes are not harm for harm's sake. The purposes were an agreed upon course of action, in their words, to work to the benefit of Juneau Avenue Partners by, to put it less artfully, playing rough with Brew City.
Is it your position, as long as there is a contract, then they can do whatever they want because they're immune from liability under the economic loss doctrine? Is that your position?
Not at all, Your Honor. The liability, first and foremost, is that the parties agree to in their contract. And we are fully ready, willing, and able to go litigate the contract claims, and that will happen. What we're saying is that in order for a party to inject punitive damages into the case, to claim that the agents who are acting on behalf of corporate parties should suffer personal liability requires real allegations that demonstrate they were acting from a personal motive, that they were acting contrary to the interests of their principal, and for the tort claim that they were acting in a manner that involves something extraneous to the contract. And we don't have that here. Their pleading is nothing but a boilerplate recitation of the elements of the civil conspiracy tort claim under 134.01, which begs the question, what conduct supports that? And when you look to the balance of the complaint, it all deals with the alleged non-performance of the contract.
Counselor, just one last question to try to be sure I understand what you said to me before. If this complaint had alleged that your clients, one, several, or all, had gone around Milwaukee saying that the plaintiffs were irresponsible business partners, were apt to default on any obligations that they might have to the city or someone else in regard to the development of this property, and so those kinds of allegations, you wouldn't say that they fell within the scope of the contract, correct?
Your Honor, if that was the tenor of the allegations, that there were communications outside the context of the parties of this contract, we went to the bankers, we went to officials, and
right.
we slandered
right.
them and libeled them, then I think it's a pretty easy argument for the plaintiffs to say that is absolutely extraneous to the contract.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chief, if I might.
Justice Butler.
I know your red light is on, counsel, but I do have a question for you regarding 134.01. And I know you tried to get it, the statute a bit earlier. You've made it a point to, on a couple of occasions, articulate the fact that we're dealing with a common law civil tort claim under the statute. Am I correct in that?
I'm glad you picked it up, Your Honor. Yes.
And the reason I'm asking the question, I'm assuming that's based upon the way the statute is phrased, creating a misdemeanor.
Yes.
In this section. Had the legislature, instead of creating a misdemeanor, had the legislature created a civil tort claim under this statute, in other words, creating a substantive claim, would this court have the power to apply the economic loss doctrine?
No. I think in the similar to the Kalin case and similar to some discussions of 100.18, although in dicta in this court, that where the legislature creates a civil claim expressly, that this court will not take common law remedies doctrines such as the economic loss doctrine to preclude those claims. And it views itself as not having the power. And I'd agree with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But Radu, and that's footnote one in O'Neill's, in your brief, recognizes that in Radu, the court based its civil tort liability, Mr. O'Neill, on the statute.
Yes, the court has...
You have to stand in front of your microphone, please.
I'll try not to look at his notes.
That's right. You've heard it all before.
I've now gone back and reviewed all of these cases going back to 1901, and what's clear are two things. And one is that this civil tort preexisted the creation of what is now Section 134.01, and what is equally clear is since that time the court has referred to the elements of 134.01, and when they cause damages, that constitutes a civil tort claim. But absolutely, the tort is informed by the elements of the statute.
Thank you. Counsel, you may proceed. William M. Cannon, representing Bruce City Development Group, LLC. Thank you, Mr. Cannon.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, and Mr. Hurdle, who is present in court. The genesis of this case involves a simple man with a little financial success in life who possessed a great love for three historic buildings in Milwaukee on the past property that represented the dreams and hard work of all the people who worked there just like him. He, after Pabst left Milwaukee, attempted to contact the owners of the property to buy these buildings. And like many other developers looking at this property, the calls were never returned until serendipitously one day one of the representatives of the owner said in response to his question that he would like to buy the three buildings. We won't sell you the three buildings, but are you interested in buying the entire parcel? Mr. Hurdle immediately said yes, and a deal was struck for him to become the owner of this parcel. He did not have the financial resources to pay the funds, and so he had to enter into a development relationship, which turned out to be with WizPark LLC. The factual background of what happened and the temporal aspects of when these events occurred, I think, are going to drive your decision, and it makes it a very simple, clear, easy decision. Under the terms of the June 5, 2002 assignment contract from Brew City to WizPark LLC, they agreed that buildings 27, 28, and 35 would be turned over to Brew City upon acquisition of the property. And just so your timeline is in focus, we have the assignment from Brew City to WizPark on June 5. The property was actually acquired on September 10 of 2002. Secondly, The 5% equity in this new entity would be paid, provided the assignment, rather, would be effective in the property when it changed hands. He would get his 5%, and so this was a specific element of the acquisition of the property that it could take place provided he gets his 5% interest in this new entity that would happen on September 10. The remediation credit of $1.7 million, originally the contract was for $12 million between Pabst and Brew City, and then when he assigned the contract, Wispark renegotiated it and said, instead of us proving to you that we are doing this historic building development, why not just give it to us right now? So they reduced the contract from $12 million to $10.3 million, thus freeing up this $1.7 million. So he, like Wispark and Juneau Avenue, should have received his share of that at the closing of this property. The contract also said the time is of the essence on all of these items. And all of these items were to be completed upon acquisition of the property on September 10, with the exception of this consulting agreement that was to take place over 2 years at $79,000 a year. That, in fact, has been paid, always late, but it has been paid. Juneau Avenue Partners did not begin life until September 6 of 2002. And Mr. Hurdle shows up at the closing on September 10 of 2002 and is expecting to receive title to the three buildings, his 10% interest in the tax remediation, and his 5% equity as required under the assignment contract. And at that time, he learns they're not going to give it to him. So the only thing he got at that meeting was his slap in the face. What happened after that is they never gave him any of those items. And so about a year and a half later, on May 17 of 2004, this lawsuit began. The evidence of the liability under the third cause of action for intentional interference, the sixth cause of action under Section 134, and the seventh cause of action under the conspiracy to intentionally interfere, has the elements that involve Mr. Frankie and Mr. Furchill. Nowhere in the complaint do we allege that they were operating on behalf of Highland Best or JTMK or Juneau Avenue Partners and that their conduct was part of that. Rather, we allege that they were acting individually. But the important aspects of what they were doing for the sixth cause of action, the Section 134 claim, is that they swore at Mr. Hurdle in front of his wife and issued expletives to him, not as part of a negotiating process, but just because of the malice that they had. They told him that they would turn the project into a Walmart. This is after the September 10 date. It's alleged in our complaint that paragraph 80, that happened in March of 2004. And they would have meetings of Juneau Avenue Partners where they would ask those in attendance, has James Hurdle suffered enough? And at the conclusion of those meetings, they would say he has not suffered enough.
Are there any allegations in the complaint that you say show that his business reputation was damaged by something that they said?
Yes, I think all of this conduct, one of them, for example, we will tie Hurdle up so that we control those buildings. They told him that
but
he was...
How does what they will do to him, tying him up, hurt his business reputation? You're losing me on that one.
Well, the business reputation is that he was in over his head. That he, in essence, that he was not competent.
Okay, so that was the inference from what was going on here.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And so then to demonstrate that he had not suffered enough, they changed the locks to the three buildings to prevent his access in March of 2004. So if this contract between Bruce City and Wiz Park had been fulfilled, all of these events would have taken place. He would have had the title, the remediation credit, the 5% interest on September 10. He showed up. They were all going to do this at this one occasion where they acquired the property. And at that meeting is when he discovered that he was not going to get anything, and they basically hung him out to dry over, well, ever since, quite frankly. So that's the procedural background. The only contract, really, we have to look at the two different elements here. The only contract in this case is between Bruce City and Wiz Park. It should have been completed by the time Juneau Avenue started their activity in the development of the parcel. Mr. O'Neill has raised the issue of, well,
I just want to reflect again on Justice Rogensack's question. So essentially in response to the question of what harm has been done with regard to your claim number six, that your response is that the damage is to his business reputation, that he's in over his head. Is that the damage you're asserting?
No, no, that's just one of the elements. But as part of the conspiracy to willfully and maliciously injure him pursuant to Section 134, they, as individuals, engaged in all of this conduct. So, for example,
what is the harm done? Right. With regard to claim number six, what's the harm done?
The harm that is done is that he was deprived of items that he had an absolute right to. And they used the malice is just evidence of how far they went to deprive him of things that he had an absolute right to. That's different than the Malecki case where the doctor sued the Fine Lando Clinic, and one of the reasonings of this court was, well, he didn't have a right to referral of patients, he didn't have a contract to get a referral of patients, and he didn't meet the criteria of having two people conspire against him. Dr. Koh had, there was no evidence that Dr. Koh, who ultimately apparently got the referral of the patients, did anything to him. So that's the,
yes. From what you're describing, you're saying he was entitled to these things, he didn't get these things. Isn't that really, in essence, a breach of contract claim?
Not on the 134 claim. I'm not alleging, we are not alleging that under 134, that gave rise to a duty on behalf of Juneau Avenue to give them the buildings. We're saying that's a separate independent tort, like Justice Rogensack was questioning Mr. O'Neill.
See, I think that's what Justice Bradley was asking you about, I was asking you about, not Justice Crooks. Claim 6, if it is to stand as extra contractual, has to have some harm that's caused that is not just breach of contract. It's a slander claim. Generally, people say my business reputation in the community has been damaged. And when I asked you, you said to me, well, there was the inference that he was in over his head, that he was incompetent. Well, certainly as a businessman, you don't want that reputation. And so I think that's kind of what we're trying to... And then Justice Bradley asked you, well, what's the harm done for Claim 6? So we need you to focus on that, aside from the contract, if there is anything aside from the contract.
Well, one of the allegations of the complaint is also that they interfered with the potential clients of Bruce City. There's an allegation in the complaint that Hofbrauhaus, which is a German restaurant, was intending to become one of the tenants of Bruce City. And Mr. Hurdle was dealing with Hofbrauhaus as a prospective tenant. Juneau Avenue Partners and or Mr. Frankie and Mr. Furchel asked him whether they could talk with his prospective tenant. He said, no, I'd really prefer you not to do that, and I would want to be present in any event. Well, independent of that, they went directly to the Hofbräuhaus, and all of a sudden, after that meeting, the Hofbräuhaus decided to go things more slowly and, in fact, never did anything at the site. So I think, again, this is at a motion-to-dismiss stage, so the facts still need to be developed. I think it's premature on some of these issues. There's been an absence of information, not only the documents of what transpired at the September 10 agreement acquisition date. That's not in here. What happened at those meetings? What happened between Highland Best, Wiz Park, and JTMK? Those are unknown, so we're left to deal with allegations at this point that have to be developed by the factual record.
Mr. Cannon, is 134.01 limited to injury to reputation, or does the statute cover more than that?
I think it covers more than that. Under Section 134, it's an injury to a business in addition. Any two or more persons who shall combine, undertake, or act in concert together for the purpose of willfully or maliciously injuring another in his or her reputation or business or profession are liable under the statute. And here we've alleged that Mr. Frankie and Mr. Furchel, not as part of the schema of an LLC, did it. I think the answer to the individual liability is a very simple one, because under 183.0304, there is an exception that imposes personal liability. It says, except that a member or manager may become personally liable by his or her acts or conduct other than as a member or manager. And then if you turn to Section 183, and this is the answer to the question of personal liability of Mr. Furchel and Mr. Frankie, regardless of in what capacity they acted, because they wore many hats and they all appear to be black hats to me. But under 183.0402, duties of managers and members of an LLC, no member or manager shall act or fail to act in a manner that constitutes any of the following. Under sub B, a violation of criminal law, which we allege in for the purposes of this argument, they committed a crime by their conduct in violation of Section 134.02, and sub D, willful misconduct, which is also covered if you violate Section 134.01. So they have individual liability. Those are the allegations of the complaint, and that answers, I think, conclusively the issue of their individual liability.
Mr. Cannon, the Court of Appeals, in its decision, adopted a malevolent action exception to the economic loss doctrine. And my understanding of what this court did in Colati was that it adopted a narrow fraud and in the inducement exception, and the court rejected the broader fraud exception. Now, unless I'm misreading the Court of Appeals opinion, and correct me if I am, it seems to me that a malevolent action exception is broader than a general fraud exception. So if the court has already rejected the broader fraud exception, I'm having trouble seeing how the Court of Appeals adopted an exception that was even broader than the one that this court rejected.
Well, I think it's a matter of perspective, first of all. I don't think that, number one, the economic loss doctrine even is applicable here. 134.01 is a separate, independent duty and prohibition of conduct for everybody in the state of Wisconsin. Their argument is, hey, if you can find a contract that's somehow related to the events, everybody gets immunity. Well, that would require you to declare Section 134.01 a nullity and overturn well over 100 years of common law, judicially created doctrine that there is, in fact, civil liability and civil remedies for the violation of a criminal statute. And so the first answer is, I don't think that the economic loss doctrine applies, so you don't even have to get to the malevolent exception issue. I think what the Court of Appeals was doing was saying, look, this court has already said if you engage in intentional bad conduct and it's not interwoven into the contract, in other words, an inducement to the claim so that it would be outside of the contract, we're not going to apply the economic loss doctrine. But here you don't even have to reach that issue because these were alleged to be torts against Frankie and Furchill and the other defendants for their malevolent and willful and malicious conduct against Brewer City. So I don't think that, I think the court was trying to analogize here rather than to create a hard and fast rule, and he was looking at the Collodi decision to say, look, you've already said that an intentional misrepresentation before the contract, we wouldn't apply the economic loss doctrine to damages that then flow. And I think the court is saying here you have something that's malevolent, intentional, and it goes against a broad prohibition of conduct. I don't think the economic loss doctrine applies here at all on the Section 134 claim. And on the third and seventh causes of action, we have the general intentional interference and conspiracy to intentionally interfere. You know, they make much of this argument about paragraph 90 in our complaint, and I would begin to by saying that I think that's really irrelevant to any of the issues here. We don't have to plead the damages with specificity, number one. The wherefore clause or the allegations of what damages you suffer is really a notice element under Wisconsin law, and that does not define the claim. You have to look to the allegations of the complaint for that. And even more importantly, you can have the same types of damages that flow from a breach of a contract and an intentional interference with a contract where the person doesn't get the benefit of the bargain. So for one example, they didn't give him the building, so he didn't get a tenant and he didn't earn income. It's a breach of contract with Wispark that he didn't get the building, but also the loss of damages from the intentional interference gives the same type of damages, their money damages.
You only recover once.
Yes, you can only recover once. That's right. And the trial court will ultimately sort this out based on the evidence and the facts that are produced in discovery. These are the elements that you have proved. These are the instructions on the law of damages to what you're entitled to, and you can't get them multiple times. Absolutely. But it's a red herring because we're not at that point yet.
May I ask, if you were unable to proceed on tort claims, would contract damages be able to satisfy the harms that you allege you have suffered?
No, not at all.
Could you explain why?
Sure, and I'm just looking for one quote, and let me see if I can find it here. But for example, the injury to his business and reputation under Section 134.01, those are compensatory damages that are uncapped. If you look at the breach of the contract claim in the first and second causes of action between Brewer City and Wispark, those are specific contract damages for loss of money of the tenancy, loss of the $170,000, those for the remediation credits, those are contract damages. The injury to his reputation is a compensatory damage. They, you know, tried to tell everybody, and it's not just limited, well, for this purpose it is, but obviously they had a great deal of malice towards Mr. Hurdle, and their testimony in terms of the allegations of the complaint with the mayor, we're going to have those buildings tied up, et cetera. It's like, this guy is a nothing. He's so incompetent, we're going to be able to defeat his legal rights and control what is rightfully his. That's just wrong. I can't imagine this court ever saying, under these facts and the temporal relationship, we're going to apply the economic loss doctrine, even though there's no privity with Juno or Highland Best or JTMK LLC, we're going to apply the economic loss doctrine because somehow it's tangentially related in their theory of the law, and allow somebody to maliciously and willfully injure another businessman. What they did was leave him hanging in the wind, and I think the conduct was so outrageous that under the allegations of the complaint, he would get compensatory damages for the injury to his business and reputation, and he would be entitled to punitive damages if these allegations are concerned. So the contract damages don't cover those two items.
Mr. Cannon, am I correct that when the trial judge, Judge Sankovitz, dismissed the 13401 claim, he did it on the basis of the economic loss doctrine?
Yes.
So that's why the Court of Appeals got into this malevolent action exception?
That is correct. And I think that, again, it was the intentional misconduct by the defendants in this case in the face of an application of the economic loss doctrine to the series of events, some of which was a breach of contract with WisPark and some of which were independent torts, got the court involved into saying the economic loss doctrine can't apply here under these circumstances, and so it looked at a malevolent act exception. But it didn't really have to go that far, because the Section 13401 statute prohibited that conduct. They shouldn't have engaged in it independently.
Counselor, would you agree with me that breaching a contract, even if you do it willfully, there's nothing that would cause that conduct if it was simply a breach of contract? I don't care to perform on what I promised you. Never falls under Section 134?
Yes, I would agree just on that set of facts, yes.
And so,
it wouldn't give rise to punitive damages either.
Right, and so what you're claiming under 134 is conduct that is not, that is in addition to the conduct you're claiming was a breach of contract.
Absolutely, yes.
Where I get confused sometimes is you start saying about it was so wrong they didn't give him what he was deserving of. And to me, in my ears, that sounds like breach of contract. And I know, you know, breach of contract is not something that you look at through those kind of lenses. So just so I'm clear.
Yeah, I think you absolutely are right on that. We have two elements here. We have the breach of contract with WisPark and what was supposed to happen on September 10 and didn't happen. And then we have all of this conduct that ends up with them, you know, changing the locks to the buildings that he's entitled to, for example, as a 13401 element of a 13401 violation and evidence of their malice.
Cannon, let me ask this. I'm just trying to wrestle with the 13401 argument for a moment. The statute, the legislature in the statute, created a remedy. Now, I understand that there's a separate civil cause of action that's been recognized by this court, I believe, in Giroux. But this, the legislature created a statutory remedy, which was imprisonment for not more than 1 year and or a fine not exceeding $500. The fact that the legislature created a punishment I'm trying to follow how punitive damages flows. In other words, the legislature is spoken on what they think should happen here. This court has said in a civil action that there is a separate civil cause of action that can be created. And as I understand, at least as opposing counsel has argued, that's under the common law. So if we're dealing with a statutory remedy here and we're dealing with the common law there and the economic loss doctrine is a common law doctrine, at least as it's been argued here, I'm not sure that I'm trying to follow how, under your argument, the economic loss doctrine can never be applied to this statute.
Well, first of all, you can have a 134.01 damage and injury when there's no contract involved. So we start with that premise, number one. Number two, this court has in fact created the remedies for a criminal violation of a statute like 13401. They say you have a civil remedy. And, you know, in the original case, Hugin, the journal went down to the police court and swore out an affidavit or complaint that three other editors of competing newspapers were conspiring to hurt their business by not allowing people to advertise in their paper if they had advertised in the journal. So they went down, swore out a complaint. The sheriff went out, arrested the three men, and put them in jail. Now, those were the good old days. But the reality now, we don't do that anymore. You sue for a civil remedy. And this court has a long history of saying if you engage in willful, malicious, intentional misconduct, you're going to be entitled to punitive damages. So we're not asking you to do anything that you haven't done in the past here.
The reason I'm pressing you, Mr. Cannon, is because, as I understand, the broader fraud exception that was rejected in Kaladi, that involves willful, intentional conduct.
But that was before the contract. It was an exception to the doctrine because it was in the inducement to it. Here, we don't have any contract with Furchill or Frankie or Highland or JTMK or Juno Avno. There is no contract. So that's the difference. The other thing is that we are not claiming economic losses for the violation of the third, sixth, and seventh causes of action. In the history of the application of the economic loss doctrine, it's for the most part, with maybe one exception, always dealt with a product that was defective or didn't fulfill the expectations. And we have a long list of cases where this court in Sunny Slope held, you know, the damages caused by a failure to have a backhoe properly operate and its parts that caused damage to the backhoe and consequential damage would be covered by the economic loss doctrine because the manufacturer had a warranty and that warranty provided the privity that extended all the way down to the ultimate user or purchaser of the product. So the court, by operation of law, supplied that privity, and that's true in real estate transactions in Van Leer where you had a contaminated product. Here, we aren't claiming that there was anything wrong with the product, the real estate here, the three buildings. We aren't claiming economic loss damages. That's the key difference between this case and all the other cases that are cited in the economic loss doctrine. And so when you look at the damages that are being sought, we aren't claiming there's any defect in the product. We're perfectly satisfied with the product. It was the breach of the contract to give us what we were entitled to. I see that my time is up.
It is, counsel, and thank you for your argument.
Thank you very much.
Mr. O'Neill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the statements by Mr. Cannon, I think, was fairly revealing, and that is, from his perspective, if the defendants can find any contract, they claim everyone gets immunity. I think what this complaint demonstrates is that where a commercial party to a commercial contract has a contract claim, if they can find any tort that somehow fits with the facts they've alleged, they are going to allege it in an attempt to get punitive damages. What Mr. Cannon argued was that what we have here is a willful and malicious and wrongful and intentional breach of contract. We know there is no punitive damages available, no matter how willful, no matter how malicious, no matter how wrongful a breach of contract is.
Counsel, his response would be, no, I am alleging this malicious behavior with regard to damage to reputation and business as set forth in 134. I mean, that's what his response would be to you, I assume.
But he hasn't done that. The complaint alleges the boilerplate allegations that are necessary for a civil conspiracy claim under 134.01, which begs the question of what conduct is it that constitutes that harm for harm's sake, malicious conduct. And when you look to those 87 paragraphs that tell us what the factual background is, what you find is a breach of contract. What you find is exactly what the first 5 minutes of Mr. Cannon's argument was all about, and that is the contractual relationship between these parties, the fact that his client feels wronged because he didn't get the items he believed he was entitled to the contract on September 10th as opposed to some later date. And those are items that will be litigated in the context of a breach of contract claim.
The Court of Appeals here allowed both of the 3 and 7, if I recall, to be replet.
Correct.
So it anticipated the opportunity to put more meat to the complaint, as I understand it, both with regard to Clause of Action 3 and Clause of Action 7. They indicate they should replead. They modified the trial court's dismissal. They said the dismissal is a dismissal, as I recall, without prejudice and allowed for repleading.
And, Your Honor, that actually didn't change anything. You'll also see in the record, if you look, there are two orders entered by Judge Sankovitz. The second one was in response to an objection by Bruce City to the original order dismissing the claims, and their objection was all about the prejudice. And what Judge Sankovitz said is, look, if you have additional facts to plead that would state a tort claim against these parties who are dismissed, you have leave under 80209 to do so. They chose to stand on their complaint. So I can't engage and sit here and think what additional facts they're going to plead. They decided to stand on these facts. So that's what we have. And we have 87 paragraphs that show a contractual commercial relationship that went awry, and went awry with hard feelings, and apparently there were things stated that Bruce City didn't like and they felt was demeaning, but at the end, it just is a breach of contract. With respect
Mr.
to the
O'Neill, if I could, with respect to the 134.01, you've argued it's just a breach of contract. My question is, under the statute, injuring another's reputation, would that be considered an economic loss?
My answer to that, Your Honor, is in this case, Bruce City has alleged, as part of its contractual damages, harm to its business and reputation. Bruce City has agreed in its brief that as a corporate entity, economic loss is all that it can suffer. It can't suffer the kind of personal injury that the court has said is not part and parcel of the economic loss doctrine. So I do believe, yes, in this case, all we're dealing with is economic loss. If you go back to the Supreme Court's decision in Eastern Steamship, I think it was, what that court said is that by definition, where you don't have a personal injury and when you don't have harm to other property, what you have is economic loss. And that's what we have in this case.
Is harm to business reputation all economic loss, then, in your mind?
In this case, it is, Your Honor. And it's set forth directly in their pleadings under paragraph 90 as part of their economic loss caused by the breach of contract.
And harm to reputation, business, or profession, any claim that involves that, you would advance is barred by the economic loss doctrine?
Yes. We do contend that those damages alleged here are nothing other than economic loss.
So the economic loss doctrine would, in your interpretation, wipe out the ability to bring a claim for injury to reputation or business or profession?
Not at all. That's part of the damages they seek for the breach of contract. It doesn't wipe out a party's right to pursue damages for breach of contract. And it doesn't wipe out any claim that would be extraneous to the items.
Until now, this has been a separate tort, civil cause of action.
The conspiracy.
13401, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And the tort claim historically is viewed as the damages are really the gist of the claim. And the damages here are nothing other than the contract damages. They are inextricably tied together. And I think that speaks directly to the economic loss doctrine. Briefly, in conclusion,
you're out of time. You get one sentence.
I ask that the court remand this case for a trial on the disputed contractual issues with no threat of punitive damages or personal liability, and therefore that the Court of Appeals' decision creating a malevolent action exception is reversed, and that the court clarify the law with respect to what it takes to allege a claim individually against an agent of a corporation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill, and thank you, Mr. Cannon, for your arguments today on a subject the court's becoming very familiar with, economic loss doctrine. That ends the hearing in 04AP3238, Bruce City Redevelopment Corp. Group, LLC versus the Furchill Group. The court is in recess until 1:30 for a third oral argument. Those who wish to meet the now elusive Justice Wilcox should wait here, and he will be out promptly, and other students will be joining you. We're in recess.